Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with comedian, writer, and serious actor Bob Odenkirk. Bob has spent a lifetime just trying to get laughs. He wrote comedy for radio, for Saturday Night Live, and for countless film projects and TV shows with varying degrees of success. But it actually took a couple of dramas to change his career path and bring his extensive acting skills to the attention of mainstream America. That would be Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, Fargo, and Nebraska. Well, that's irony for you, and it's not lost on Bob. He hasn't always had an easy time of it, but then few iconoclasts do. I found him to be surprisingly uncynical about it. In his view, using comedy to connect with people and change how they view the world is a pretty cool job. What makes something funny? That's a fascinating and elusive question, and I figured there's no better brain to pick on the topic than Bob's. He joins me to talk about the transition from playing secondary roles to main characters, the stories behind some of Mr. Show's funniest sketches, and why you should never wear a fake beard to an audition. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Sam.
Thanks for coming and doing this.
Thanks for asking me to do it. You've had some of my favorite people.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
I love Will Ferrell's, I don't know him, but I love his work.
See, now that's strange to me that you don't know Will Ferrell.
It is weird.
Yeah, but you think all comedians
I think he works really a lot. He works, actually, I think more than I do, which is kind of insane.
Well, that would be insane because you've, I mean, just a quick overview of your career is like the work of three men.
Two of them are really not very good at what they do. One of them does good stuff and hooray for him, but the other two guys should just stop working and should relax because it's not important.
You know, that's a great way in because I was thinking of your speech at the Critics' Choice Award when you won Best Dramatic Actor for Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
Yeah, your statuette, you said, I'm in a drama? I was just trying to get laughs. And I think that that is like, that sums up a lot of things about sort of the odd way that your career has turned
really
in the last
weird,
five or six years.
Yeah, it's remarkable. It's worth remarking upon.
Well, let's remark upon it. Because
yeah, I will.
I think that for me, when I saw Breaking Bad, it became my favorite show on television. And I thought, there's not a show I can love more than Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
And then Better Call Saul comes along, and I love it even more. And it's
well, that's great to hear. I mean, listen, Breaking Bad, for many reasons, is really just one of the most outstanding shows of all the history of TV. The excellence of the writing, number one, and the way it's put together, the storytelling of it, which is both a tribute to Vince Gilligan, who created it, led the writing, and led the storytelling, and then, of course, Bryan Cranston and this amazing cast of actors. And then, on top of that, technology. I mean, the speed of computers, the ability to stream.
Yes, of course.
And then the fact that Netflix, you know, was getting up to speed. And then it had Breaking Bad in its third season. And that's where you could start to stream and really watch three seasons in a row. And so all these things came together for the perfect show for streaming at the perfect time. I mean, it's an insane thing that all happened kind of just at the right time because Breaking Bad didn't even do well its first two seasons. It was, I'm told, almost canceled both times. So the fact that it carried on long enough, just perfectly enough, to get on Netflix just when streaming was starting to build and people were able to stream and grasping the notion.
You're saying that no one watched the show in its first two seasons, and I read.
Did you watch it?
I did not. And I read that you didn't either.
No,
and
I didn't know what it was.
And you got to the set on Albuquerque without watching.
I probably watched 15 minutes of it. I got a sense of the tone. But look, I had kids, and I was harried with work, and I was developing shows. And I was thankful to be offered this opportunity to perform in this show, but I didn't know it well.
That's so amazing.
Now, keep in mind, it was only the second season, so only one season had played, and it was a short season. It was seven episodes.
Right.
So a lot of people, I was in a the great vast majority of people who hadn't seen it. I read the script. I thought it was really intriguing. I also thought they were going to cut it way down. So that's another reason not to bother yourself with it too much, because you get the script. And as an actor, especially in comedy, it's very common to get a script and then everything gets cut way down in comedy. Right. And I knew it wasn't a comedy, but still, I just looked at those monologues that Saul has all the time, but certainly in the first episode that he appears in. And I thought, well, you know, it's just going to – they're probably going to turn this into two lines, you know. So I don't have to study it that well. I don't even have to – I'm not going to memorize it until they figure out what they really need.
You were being efficient.
Yeah. I mean, I was being realistic, I thought. And then I watched some of the show, but I knew what it was from talking to people. I knew it was a drama, and I knew it was pretty intense, and I thought that was exciting.
You knew you were playing alone.
And I was thankful for that opportunity, but I didn't stop and watch seven episodes. I don't even know if you could have at the time. I don't know where you would have watched them.
That's a good point. So do you recall when
don't
you
– fucking yell at me. I'm sick of this shit.
But I do think it's interesting that the part that sort of changed your path in life, it's an interesting comment on – how we don't often know the things that are going to end up having great effect on our lives, right?
Mm-hmm. And absolutely.
Had you have known that, you probably would have
tried.
Really tried to understand the show.
Tried to be a better actor.
Right. No, but do
you try a little harder? No, I took it very seriously, but it only, I mean, I've joked about it, but it's kind of true. It's like, there are probably a few exceptions to this little statement I'm going to make, but when people say, well, you're doing great and whatever, this is great, I don't think it's an uncommon experience to feel like, well, I've always tried. Everything I've done, I tried at. It's not like all those movies and things I did that didn't work, all the ones you've never seen, that I was doing my best. I was always doing my best, but your point is an interesting one, because the point is, yeah, you did your best with those and they didn't work, and then here comes one and things just fit. I certainly would never have predicted that Breaking Bad would have been an important thing to my career. And again, it's not really something I can take credit for. I was watching it with my wife the other night, because I do try to keep track of what happens on Better Call Saul. That like it's a joke. I'm very occupied with my life, my personal life. I got two kids, and I'm really trying to help my son out right now. He's going through a rough time. And so that really occupies my mind pretty much 24 hours a day. And then secondly, just from training of, you know, being a comedy writer and waking up every day with putting a blank piece of paper in front of me and go and fill this up with something funny, I walk around going, what can I write? What can I do? What is an idea? You know, it's just you train your brain, you know? And so I forget, you know, that I've acted and that, oh, I'm on this show. I should watch that show. And you just – those other things, one being the personal life thing and two being just how you train your brain for years. And me as a comedy writer and – as I said, when I did Breaking Bad, I was in the midst of a couple years of failed pilots and feature films I was writing that weren't going anywhere. But that's your life. I mean, you develop. You try to develop things.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I was watching it the other night with my wife, Better Call Saul, and thinking, okay, well, I just fit this part for whatever reason. I mean, I don't know if it's so much a tribute to some skills I might have as just the perfect marriage of a character to a person's energy, real energy, that marries up really well and makes it work. And it's funny in the right way. It's funny and is true and honest in some way. There's luck involved. I mean, the bottom line is, with all the things that we all do in entertainment, you know, there's luck involved. So, you know, you hope it comes together.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. We should say it's a prequel to Breaking Bad. It takes place sometime about 8 years before Breaking Bad started, and you play Jimmy McGill, mm-hmm. who eventually becomes Saul Goodman in Breaking Bad, apparently. But what's fascinating about that construct is that it's I think about it like seeing home movies of your parents before they had kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like you can't recognize those people.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you had to figure out how to play him like from scratch as if he was a totally different character than Saul
Goodman.
Yes,
I did.
You did?
Yeah, but it wasn't I think the part of it that maybe is interesting is that it's not like I had to clean the palate. It's not like I had to wipe away a bunch of knowledge and sort of performance choices that I did as Saul. Because Saul was this very he was a presentation. He said in the first time you see him, look, this isn't who I am. My name is Saul. My name is not Saul Goodman. I'm James McGill. This is a front. The whole thing's a front.
Right.
So he was always putting on a show. That was part of the fun of playing him. That was part of the fun of, I think, watching him. But it's very easy to play a person one way at their office, especially if it's a comical facade of an office, and then go, okay, now we're going to take that guy. He's going to walk into this house, and there's his brother who's sick.
Right.
And be a different person or play a very different energy and not have any feelings of like this is contradicting that other guy, because it's understandable. It's just natural, you know.
Well, you bring up an interesting point about the nature of a supporting actor versus a lead actor too, because a supporting actor comes in and we see them through the eyes of the lead character. So
we
always sort of saw Saul through Walter White. Did you have to make that transition as an actor to go, now, wait a minute, I have a much larger playing field here because they're coming to me.
Thrilled that I had that much larger playing field and honored, really. I did sort of, you know, people ask me, you know, what's it like to be number one on the call sheet? Because on a TV show or movie, the main character is going to be number one. And then I guess people who give a shit about that kind of thing really pay attention. One day I'm going to be number one, which is like, what does it matter? I mean, it's just your part is your part and just do it well and don't worry about what number it is on the fucking technical sheet. But anyways, if there is a difference, if there's anything I've noticed, you know, look, the lead character can make choices that come out of their own psychology and not out of the pressures of their world around them so much. Whereas the side characters or secondary characters are very much reacting oftentimes to the plot or the lead character's choices.
Right.
So in Breaking Bad, Walter White does things that he does not need to do except because of his own personal fucked upness. When he's supposed to return that car, that sports car that he got for
his son,
and he goes on the joyride and just fucks it up. I mean, that choice and plot is completely justified and perfect and says a lot about him and fits and is also fun.
Yeah.
But he doesn't need – there's no –
it's not advancing the story.
He could just return the car.
Right, right.
And nobody would go, wait, shouldn't he be on a joyride?
Right.
No, but at the same time, when he goes on the joyride, you go, oh, right.
I understand.
He's got something wrong inside that makes him do these things. And it's a choice that is not dictated by anything but the person's character. And I think that that's where you see in your story, and sometimes if you break down as an actor, you take your script and you go, why am I doing this? Why am I saying that? And you'll find then in there, it's just pure character that is speaking through you and choosing a direction, and not so much as a side character, oh, well, I have to respond to the moment at hand. And there's a more of a discovery when you're the lead.
Less obligation to.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, then there's the tribute to these writers again of just such a complicated guy and such a rich backstory.
Well, it brings up so many questions. I mean, that show is amazing in the time that it gives itself to let things play out.
Well, I think the ingenuity of storytelling and discovery and the trust in the audience.
Yes.
And this is where I'm out of my depth and out of my wheelhouse. And people ask me, are you going to write a Better Call Saul? I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? Do you see what I write? I write crazy comic insanity. I don't write delicate, dramatic, self-revelation, emotional discovery, I don't know, of a character. I mean, Vince and Peter and the whole writing staff have shown such faith in the audience. And, of course, they use all their skills and they ask themselves very hard questions as they write. But still, the faith they've shown that people will watch closely and be motivated and be compelled by these characters and their psychology, which is really what's going on. That's what's at war.
Did you watch Bryan Cranston and sort of store it away when you watched him be that lead character? And I mean, obviously, you weren't on set
I did, and it might have been just to protect myself, you know, was I really not until I saw the billboards go up for the first season did I feel any pressure about being the lead.
Really?
I saw that billboard and went, oh, my character's the lead. Wow, I hope I did a good job. I mean, until then, and again, it might just be some kind of compartmentalization, or it just might be from years of getting my ass kicked in show business. I did sit down with Brian, and I said, "How do you do this job?" And Brian was being very encouraging to me and supportive, and saying things like, "You can do it, man. You know, you're up for it, and these guys are going to write you a great thing." And I said, "No." The weird thing is, it was like, I know I can do it. which is to say, I ran Mr. Show, I mean, with David Cross.
Sure.
But I've put myself out there before. So I know what it's like to say, okay, I'm going to lead the army. Let's go. And we might be walking into a ditch, marching into a ditch, but I can do it. I can take the hit, ego-wise or whatever. But more importantly, like, how do you actually do – what does your day look like? And he goes, oh, okay, here's what you do. You get to set. You've learned your lines. You work. At lunch, you study your lines. You get to set. You work. You ask them to make you dinner, like a sandwich or something from the cart. And then you bring that home so you don't have to make dinner because you need to work when you get home. And then you work at night, and then you go to bed. And then you do that again the next day. And then on weekends, you rehearse and learn your lines. So
he wasn't being facetious.
No. I said, like,
that's the deal.
What does your day look like? And then that was reassuring. I mean, I walked away from that going, okay, right. You just work constantly and then you'll be okay. And that's what I did.
Wow.
Yeah. Because you know what? We shoot the show in 8 days. So you don't have a lot of time. So you really need to know your stuff when you get to the set. You need to know it really well. And I like rehearsing with the other actors, and Ray Seahorn and Michael McKean. I have some pretty heavy scenes with those two, sometimes with Jonathan Banks as well. But my big scenes tend to be with Ray and with Michael. And they're
right.
Always up for a weekend, you know, spending a couple hours on the weekend, you know, putting it on its feet, you know.
Well, you know, you shortchanged yourself a minute ago when you said that I don't write dramatic, heartfelt, emotional things. I write sketch comedy. But, you know, I was thinking a little bit about what kind of an observationalist.
You were thinking about F.F. Woody Cooks.
I was not thinking about F.F. I was thinking actually about the Gibbons versus Fairsley, the Mr. Show
sketch.
Well,
it's a smart sketch. I mean, it's about politics, and it's about, you know, how
it's about the American, like, the idea of, can you get ahead anymore by being honest?
That's true, we were actually riffing on, in a way, it was on political ads.
Yes. Well, point being that I think that you have to be a really fine-tuned observer of, like, to write a great comedy sketch, you have to be able to break down sort of human behavior and existence and put it into a very compressed, like, you have to get a lot of information to the audience very quickly. And I think that that takes a certain skill that...
I think the only thing I'll give you in that, and I won't go all the way with you on that. I really do think that there's a level... I mean, it's certainly with Better Call Saul, because Better Call Saul, even beyond Breaking Bad, in this distinctive kind of internal storytelling way, I mean, there... With Breaking Bad, you had meth and you had drug dealers and you had guns. And this show, I mean, it's people fighting for their egos and their personal sense of themselves. That's what they're trying to protect. That's what they're trying to...
It's subtle. That's what you're saying.
Very, very internal.
Yeah.
And they're making it work for an audience. They're making it work for you, that you are like, oh, shit, come on, get that thing or... make it work, or, you know, you're feeling so motivated and you're feeling so compelled by this stuff.
Well, I'll give you that, but I can't go all the way with you because I think you're being a bit self-effacing of your own
writing
talent.
Well, okay, so here's what I would say. And there's a great sketch. One of my favorites, maybe my favorite from Mr. Show, is the story of Everest.
Oh, yeah.
Where
I showed my daughter that yesterday.
And where Jay is knocking the thimbles over, and I'm getting really mad. You did?
Yeah.
Did
she like I showed it? She loved it.
But what is that really about? It's about your family. It's about your family, and the fact is that when you achieve anything, and this guy climbed Mount Everest.
That's right.
It counts for nothing. Your family is completely... distracted by secondary small, it just always happens that they are just because of the way they know you.
It's just the Everest is the outlier.
Yeah,
that's
strangers
not who you
go,
are.
Hooray! You climb Mount Everest. You're amazing. You're a hero. And your family goes, yeah, but when you came in and told the story, you knocked over the thimbles. Talk about that. I mean, Mom's thimbles. You knocked her thimbles over.
That was
Talk
a funny
about
story.
That.
Yeah.
You know, tell the real story, you know. And it's just how everything you do in within your family gets transformed into something meaningless and small and kind of – and it's just incredibly frustrating. So I would say you're right.
You're making
And we're
point.
Smart
yeah.
by being able to see, like – okay, there's this hilarious joke. He can't stop falling down, and Jay falls better than anybody since John Cleese. But also, come on, let's face it. Everyone can relate to what's really at the core of this, which
That's
is,
right.
you know, your family. And
well, I you know, I think it brings up the something you said that hit me so true that you discovered early on, which is that comedy is really honesty. It's
yeah,
about honesty.
Yeah. And you know, we've been talking a lot about Gary Shandling the last few weeks because he passed away.
Yeah.
And we should talk about him more and for a long time because he was one of the greats. I don't like using the word was. But he talked about honesty, comedy being about honesty.
Well, explain that to me, how that
You know, I mean, Gary's comedy, The Sanders Show, was how, you know, in showbiz, because it always started with the show, there's this presentation of your persona and your ego that's kind of palatable to the world.
Right.
You know, you're interested in the other person, they have a talent they want to show, and we're all happy here, and it's runs smoothly, and it's entertaining, and it's a performance, but you're playing yourself, even on a talk show.
But it's a performance.
And then he took you backstage, and there's all these egos at war, and there's the honest, the truth to that behavior, the real truth. Is that there's warring egos going on constantly as soon as they yell cut.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's Gary showing all this honesty about human behavior in a realm that he knows very well, obviously.
Do you remember when you discovered that truth? Like,
it took me a long time to sort of think I could be in show business. Monty Python was my first love and sort of remains so. I just think it kind of – and as if you think about that shit for a long time, you're going to, I think, go, what the hell is going on here? What is this about? Why do I like this so much?
Why did it work on you?
Why does it work on me? What does it say? What is it saying? Python is so absurd. I mean, you could say it's not saying anything. But it is. I mean, it's saying that people are fucking ridiculous. And so why does that compel me? Why does that truth resonate so deeply with me? It means a lot to me to hear that. I mean, my friend Steve Meisner, very close friend of mine from childhood, and he loved Python and still does. And Steve told me that, you know, he had a really challenging family situation with a lot of pressure and a lot of pain and, oh, my God, torture, really. And
how so?
Well, his dad was a fucking asshole, an alcoholic. And, so this kid was just suffering. And then at some age, I think around 9 or 10, he was hanging out with his older sister, and her friend had a Python on TV or somehow had, you know, we didn't have even VHS, so I don't know how. He showed Steve Monty Python, and Steve said, it was like the world became in color, and I felt so reassured and connected to these guys and to this voice. Well, what was that voice? I mean, it was saying that, you know, come on, the world's a bunch of fucking crazy assholes. I mean, everyone's a fucking idiot. And, well, and that truth made him feel connected and was in a, you know, it just changed how he viewed the world. And I think that's a pretty cool thing to think about and know and try to achieve, too, with the work you do.
Well, you think about as a kid, your parameters are pretty small, and your parents are the thing you see as normal.
Yeah.
And until you see the rest of the world, and some people never get that chance.
Yeah.
You don't know. So I'm sure everybody, I'm sure there was a time for you when your horizons expanded too.
Yeah, I mean, listen, my dad was a difficult guy, but he loved comedy and he was funny. He kind of loved some pretty immature stuff.
He did.
He loved Hee Haw.
He did.
Yes, he did.
So would you guys watch Hee Haw together?
We had to watch Hee Haw, but I would watch Hee Haw.
Do you remember when you
I kind of hated it a little.
Do you remember when you found you could make your dad
and
laugh?
And I kind of liked it. I could never make my dad laugh.
You're kidding.
Well, he died before I got a chance to, really. He died when I was like 21 or 22. I didn't know him that well. He kind of disappeared for 5 or 7 years, and then there was a phone call. He's dying. So then we got to see him again for a couple weeks.
Oh, that's terrible.
But we never connected, really. And that was actually weirdly kind of a great thing to feel. Because I remember when he took off, like thinking, I wonder if I didn't connect with him because I was just a kid and I was an asshole. Or if it was like we would never really connect. And so when we got this call and he was dying and it was like, come see him, I was like, well, this is great. I'm older now. I was 22. Let me see if I can talk to him. Maybe I was just a kid, and maybe I can really connect with this guy. Because I always knew he was funny. He would make jokes, and
he had timing.
Yeah, he had some timing and his sense of he had some really good sense of humor of jokes, which is not really my sort of way in. But still, I like good jokes, but I don't really. That's not really how I approach it. And I went and hung out with him, and I hung out with him probably 10 times maybe, and I thought, oh yeah, okay, we're not gonna connect ever. So
really,
at least it wasn't something I can feel bad about the rest of my life.
So you worried, you kind of took it on yourself as a kid, like,
yeah,
maybe
like
it's my
maybe
fault.
It was me because I just fucking hated him for bringing so much chaos into our lives, you know what I mean? Which would be understandable, but still, maybe we could have connected. But it was a feeling of like, no, we're never going to connect. So it's okay. We're just very different people. My dad had this thing of like, and there's lots of people like this, but comedy people aren't like this. everything became a dollar sign to him. It was the weirdest thing. Like, so-and-so, how's so-and-so doing? I already fucking got a job with these guys, and he got, you should hear what he got when he left the other company. He got, like, 2 years of salary. I mean, yeah, good luck to him. I mean, like, what, that's, everything in the whole world is about how much money you made off it, or, like, who gives a shit? Did he have enough money to buy lunch? All right, well, beyond that, what else can we talk about? Who gives a shit? You know, I mean, at a, I never cared.
And that didn't rub off on you, and that's good that it didn't.
But I can't imagine looking at the world that way. I mean, outside of making enough money to live, which is hard for a lot of people. And,
yeah.
And, you know, once you've done that, okay, now let's stop talking about money now, from now on.
So you just really weren't like your dad.
Yeah, I think that fundamentally we weren't like each other. And so that's kind of an okay thing. I mean, look, there's a lot of people who have that experience with their parents, a lot of people. But I think there's something reassuring about, as an adult, going, it wasn't me, it wasn't my childhood, we're very different people, so we're never going to connect, and that's okay.
But I do wonder if part of trying to be funny, trying to create something genuinely funny that resonates, I wonder who that's for.
Yeah, well, I think that you got to be careful about that. I mean, that can't be your first impetus, is I want to create something that really resonates or connects.
No, but
I mean,
but
that always comes after. That
right.
comes, that's like you've got the sketch and you either are just delighted by, oh, look, there's a dimension to it that's kind of meaningful. That's neat. It's that. It's never you lead with it. And the only way it's an operative factor ever is maybe you're working on something and you're wondering sort of where does this go?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Where does this little story go? Because that's the neat thing about David Cross. And I think what I feel like, when I worked with Robert Smigel, and Smigel was really the first guy who showed me sort of the bones of a sketch and how you write it.
And that was
it made
Saturday
me think
Night
about
Live.
That, yeah.
Right.
But he just always, from when we were young and we were roommates back in Chicago, he just really had a great sense of the layout of a sketch and the bones of a sketch. And he would use the term core joke, with the core joke. And then David, when I went to the Ben Stiller show, wrote this sketch, TJO Pooter Toots. It was a story. It was like this little mini story. It was a parody, but it was more like that he had gotten story into a sketch. It worked as a sketch. It worked in a 6-minute increment or 4 or 5 minute, whatever it was. And it worked as a sketch, but it had a little story to it. It had more story than I'm used to seeing. And I thought, wow, that's neat. You can get story into these things too. That can work too. So that's the kind of thing that where you go like maybe in the course of writing you go like, where does this thing go? And then you kind of look at it and say, well, what's really happening here? What's the kind of operative human behavior going on?
Right.
And then that leads you to a build. But beyond that, I mean, you know, just try to be funny. That's the job.
Right, right.
You know, try to be funny, and who gives a shit? At a certain point, if it's
sure.
funny, you know, I mean, there's nothing I love more than Jackass, you know? And you can sit here and talk about how Jackass is about especially guy behavior.
Yeah.
And it is. It is. I mean, there's something, you know, my favorite things in Jackass are when they, like, take the bike and there's a ceiling fan. And they, like, do a little ramp or they do a skateboard into the ceiling fan. They put a helmet on. And that is my favorite shit because there's no story. There's no prank to it at all. It's just literally a guy's brain. Every guy, I think, and I certainly relate to it, has looked at a ceiling fan and in the fucking base elemental, like, iguana dinosaur level of brain gone, I wonder if I stuck my hand into that.
Yeah.
I wonder if I punched that. I wonder if I stuck a stick in that. You know, it's just, you can't help it. It's
that's
just
how we're,
deep
that's
inside
how we're wired.
You to want to try to do that shit.
Yeah.
So they're connecting to you on a really basic, awesome level. And if you want to say what's the truth about human behavior, I don't know. It's a, there's a truth to it.
I totally agree.
You know, there's a great, like, connection. So I would just want to put the whole conversation in some context of, like, people say you can't talk about comedy, you know, you ruin it. And I guess you do. I mean, I don't know. I'll still watch the Everest sketch and laugh. You're not going to stop me from laughing at that because somebody talked about why it resonates.
I like to understand how these ideas start and form and where they come from, because some people can do it.
Well, I just wrote a sketch and I did it at, so I guess I could talk about something fairly fresh. I did it in Portland at my friend Tom Johnson's theater, The Brody. I was up in Portland and whenever I go to Portland, I do shows at The Brody because it's this little space and I can feel like I can do things in an experimental way, right? And nobody's going to. Everybody's not going to judge it or think I'm trying to sell them a TV show.
Right.
I'm just doing a comedy sketch that I wrote that I like. So one was about a couple, and they're having an anniversary dinner, their seventh anniversary. And my wife and I, you know, we have these great dinners, and we give each other presents and cards and this guy's had an affair this year, and this is where he's going to tell his wife, but with presents. So the first present is a hat that says shithead on it.
Right.
And she's like, why are you giving me this? And he goes, that's for me to wear, because guess what? I had an affair this year, and I'm a shithead for doing that. And I'm going to wear this hat whenever you tell me. And she's like, wait a second, take it back. He's like, hold it, I'm not done. You got two more presents. And then there's a shirt that says, I married a dum-dum. And that's for you to wear because I had that affair, remember? She's like, yeah, I remember, you just told me. Anyway, what was I telling you? I you know, we have these, we have anniversary dinners, and it's a chance to say something. It is often a chance to say it was a rough year, right?
Yeah,
we had a rough time.
Right. But we're still
and
together.
And I'm sorry that it was rough.
Yeah.
And so, obviously, if you had an affair, that would be insane and wrong. But it's also very much a guy thing, the notion of, like, here's a present.
Like, you know, to get
okay,
it totally
right?
wrong.
We're all right, right?
Yeah.
Leave me alone. So, well, anyway, so where does it come from? It's like we had an anniversary, my wife and I, a month and a half ago. And it occurred to me that, like, what if you'd had an affair? And that's what you were trying to say, I'm so sorry. And then you did these really dumb. So it comes from, you know, you just, what's happening to you in your life. There, the other sketch we did there was, I've been on both sides of the audition table a lot. You know, I've produced, I've directed,
sure.
and I've acted a lot. So I've been on both sides a lot. And how you approach an audition is a tricky thing, you know, because you kind of want to do a great, great job. Really, you want to kick ass as an actor. That's your key, is to just go in there and slay them.
Yeah.
But also, obviously, if you make a strong choice and you make the wrong choice, I guess that could be a mistake, right? But really, I don't think it is. I think that you make your choice as good as you can, and then you just fucking kill with it. And if it's the wrong choice, well, then you shouldn't have the role anyway. You shouldn't want the role because that's how you want to play it. And if they don't like that, then you don't want to be there fucking dealing with negotiating how to play it.
That's right.
But anyhow, some actors dress up as the character, which I've always thought is the mistake. And sitting on the other side of the table is a mistake because there's a kind of emotional hijacking of the moment by dressing up. It's like you went too far and now we have to feel bad about not giving you the part, even though you haven't even done it for us yet. But it's almost like you're bringing guilt into this immediately.
That's right.
Immediately. Because you've already gone so far, and you rode your bike here with the hat and the wig and a fake mustache
and a
bolo tie. And I have to feel bad about all that effort you put in because I'm not going to give you the part. And you haven't even started doing it yet. Anyway. Don't dress up in the costume.
If we've learned nothing else today.
Fuck. Am I really telling you this whole premise?
I think so.
Do you want to hear
we're
it?
I do. We're far enough into it.
You should cut this.
No, this is good. So
I play a great actor, like a famous Shakespearean actor,
right,
is coming in to audition for like a Lord of the Rings wizard part. And he comes in and he's got a sleeping bag around his shoulders, a little party hat on, and a shitty, cheap party store beard.
Right.
And the producers are like, okay, why do you have the sleeping bag? Is that... He's like, well, the script says I have a cloak, a glorious cloak. I borrowed this from my nephew. Oh, and the hat, he has this hat, and, you know, I got it at the store, and he takes it off and throws it on the ground because he knows, like, oh, I fucked up. I didn't need to do this. They're like, look, you did not need to dress up. I mean, you got this part of – you didn't have to read. You said you wanted to read for this. You didn't need to because, boy, if you want it, it's yours. I mean, we're thankful you even showed up. I mean, so you didn't need the sleeping bag and you didn't need the hat and you didn't need that cheap beard.
Right.
And then when he hears cheap beard, he goes, the beard's real. And they go, what? This is my beard. This is a real beard. And it's obvious.
But it's clearly not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so then it becomes about this guy going, and this, you know, this great Shakespearean actor going, no, the beard is mine. But we can see the elastic. No, no, you're mistaken. I grew this beard. This beard grew from my face. God gave us this beard. And he just commits to selling them on the beard is real. And then that's what the sketch becomes about. And it goes other places,
right,
too. But that comes from the fact that I've sat in auditions and gone, oh, fuck, he dressed up. Oh, Jesus.
But what's amazing is those observations and then be able to, whatever it's finding the core joke or the architecture of it, and finding a way to do that in a way that makes it relatable to someone who hasn't sat in auditions.
You know what was so great about doing that little scene was I wasn't sure the audience would get all the ego shit that's going on in that moment because a lot of people aren't in show business. But the second I said, I played the guy, the second I said the beard is real, they started laughing. Like they understood that he was trying to protect his ego. He felt embarrassed that he dressed up at all. He knew he'd made the wrong choice.
Right.
And they laughed immediately. And I was like, well, we're okay now.
It always works, doesn't it? When it comes from someplace real, it always translates.
I think, yeah, you got to lay it out for people, clearly.
You said once, because there's something broken in me, I will be writing sketch comedy forever. Because someone could look at you and say, well, he's got this incredible part now, and he can ease off the gas a little bit on those kinds of
things. I think I have eased off the gas. And I truly am asking myself, is there anything more I can do with this dimension that Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould have allowed me to, you know, explore? But, yeah, I mean, I think those things that you do that are your first loves and that, you know, you put the 10,000 hours into. Yeah, I think there's something broken inside you, and that's not necessarily a bad thing at all. But, you know, acknowledge it.
I mean, I almost get the sense that if you went on vacation, maybe 3 days in, you might be sketching something.
Yeah.
You might be writing something down.
Well, I would, because I don't like vacations. I mean, I like a vacation where you do a show. The trip in Portland, that was a vacation.
Right, that was a vacation, but then you're doing a show.
But I'm like, let's do a show while we're there. A lot of sketches in Mr. Show came from me and David Cross and the New York Times. And that's really, we would sit in the office and read the paper and just go, what about this? This is insane and this is dumb. And
well, I watched that Netflix documentary on the making of With Bob and
Oh,
David,
yeah, yeah,
which
yeah.
was such a great documentary.
You know, I was so against that being made because it just seemed like, that seemed like a step too far into,
the
let's
process.
Talk about breaking down comedy. That,
right.
that doing that seemed like, well, that is really, I mean, us talking about things that we've thought of because we've thought about it a lot seems like at least you're, you know, encapsulating your conclusions into a paragraph or two. That seemed like, are you really going to watch us grind this shit out? But then they cut it together really well.
Yeah.
And
it's a fascinating look into the process of, you know, and especially to see the finished sketch juxtaposed with when the idea was originally germinating. But I watch that and I go, well, first off, to me, it's fascinating to look into the process of how no one really people are getting their egos stepped on, and it's all in the service of what makes the best sketch.
Yeah.
And seeing the way you work, and it doesn't surprise me that it was you and David in the New York Times, because it seems like a very natural riffing, trying to find the funny.
Yeah.
You know? But when I watched that, I thought about your relationship with David Cross, because you wrote for Saturday Night Live for 4 years.
Yeah.
You leave the show. You start Mr. Show eventually with David.
Like 3 years later, yeah.
3 years later. It brings up a question about partnerships, and what about him specifically made you better?
Well, he knows how to spell a lot of words.
That was it. It was just the
didn't have to have that fucking dictionary.
Yeah.
Well, David's definitely one of the funniest people on earth. But I think he appreciates that my brain has this sort of sketch structure ability, and that I can kind of help put things into shape. So he appreciates that. I'm like a machine.
Is there a competition?
You know
there?
What I'll tell you? No.
So it's not like you want to.
No, that's the weird thing is that he knows why I think it's funny. I know why he thinks it's funny. We both know why the better choice is B and not A. You don't even have to say. You don't have to delineate every fucking thing that's bothering you about the piece you're writing or whatever. So that's just a bit of magic that we didn't have no responsibility for and no real explanation for. And it's amazing that it carries on. I mean, through now, yeah. I mean, we both feel the same way today as we did the first day we met working together. We've done a lot over the years. We've done a lot, and people haven't seen all of it. We've written a few screenplays that didn't get made for some, I think, for fairly good reasons.
You've been hard on yourself about your past screenplays. When you,
no,
when
I
you
haven't.
Speak about that.
No, I've been totally honest.
Well, you've been honest.
I've written like probably 12 or 15 screenplays. And I think one's really good. It's an adaptation, though, of a book called The Fuck Up that I loved. And I figured something out there.
You think one is good out of all?
One's particularly good. And then this one called Annie Jenkins is kind of a great little indie. But it'll never get made. And it's probably past its sell-by date. And one's a curious little fun little movie that we actually got to make. It's very much of a light little film.
Which
it's almost
that?
Like a sketch that? Made into a film. And that's Girlfriend's Day.
Girlfriend's Day, which
that
is
we got
coming
to
out.
Make. It'll come out on Netflix. But it's very slight, but fun. And then the others are a big old fucking mess. And the sketch movies we've written, there's funny shit in there. And look, one of the things with show business is, and it's funny because when something works, you get all this credit for being so smart.
A genius.
And, yeah, right? And the fact is, you're always rolling the dice. You're always rolling the dice. And hopefully you made an honest effort every time, right?
Yeah.
So when something doesn't work, I guess it's legitimate to say, oh, well, I wasn't even trying. And then the person can go, oh, well, it didn't work out either. So, I mean, you should try next time.
Yeah.
And then you can say, well, you're right. I really should.
But that's not the truth.
But that's usually not the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, usually the truth is that thing that you did great with, you fucking worked really hard and concentrated on, and you tried your best to sort it out, and it got sorted out. And that thing that sucked, you did your best. You tried like hell to sort it out, and you didn't sort it out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what's the difference to you as the person? I mean, that's where you go, I'm glad that one worked out. I hope the next one does. I can't guarantee it. I mean, I have the same tools, the same brain, and I'm putting it to just the same amount of effort. Right. So I can't, you know, I think, you know, when you look at Woody Allen interviews, he seems to imply what I'm saying right now. He's like, it's a numbers game. I just keep making them, and every fourth one is a fucking classic. There's a guy who's taken the same set of skills, whatever. They haven't mutated that much. And then just applied himself equally every time. And then here are these classics. every 5 years. Like, unbelievable, amazing, perfect pieces of work. And then also, here are these dogs. Boom, boom, right. Boom, or boom. Not too many, I would say, but...
Or it's incredibly depressing because here's a genius who still only has a success, you know, 33% of its time.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, which one is it?
Yeah.
But, you know, I do think that you've crossed this threshold now with Better Call Saul, with Nebraska and Breaking Bad and Fargo to some extent. You've crossed this threshold into sort of being, you have a lot of opportunity. You know, I mean, it makes it, it's funny when you look back at your life because you got Breaking Bad in your 40s and it opened up this whole new avenue for you. And before that, you were directing some films, directing some commercials, writing some sketch comedy, but not, it's funny to see, like, I wonder if that came along right at the right time for you. You know, do you ever imagine a universe
10 years later, I wouldn't have had much time left. So it, thank God. Yeah.
And do you ever think about what would have happened if that one job, if you didn't do that one?
Yeah, I mean, look, I would just do what I do. I do. It's not hard for me to envision what I would be doing.
No, but I think the opportunity now that you have is amazing.
True. Absolutely true. I actually have I haven't figured it out yet, what it means.
Right.
You know, I mean, when I think about it, the first thing it means is I have to do this job well.
Right.
I have to do Better Call Saul as well as I can for however long it lasts. That's number one, job number one. I'm thankful to have it. I'm thankful it's landed as it has. I'm thankful we've gotten into it as far as we have, sort of safely. And now my first responsibility is to carry on doing it as well as I can. Because the other thing about that is whatever roles may exist off it, or in other parts of the business, or I can't imagine a very much of a richer, more surprising role existing anywhere.
I
mean,
totally
this
agree.
Thing is still being discovered every episode, every season. There's a new sort of side to his character and to his story. I don't think we're done when we get to Breaking Bad. I mean, they've had two season openers that started after Breaking Bad. So that leads me to think that Vince and Peter might want to explore the character as a guy putting his life back together.
Post-Breaking Bad.
I mean, I think maybe.
You could be doing this till you're 80.
Well, look, if they keep figuring out story, you know, I'll go as far as it can go. Because it's an incredibly rewarding challenge.
Well, listen, it's the show I look forward to most.
Well, thanks.
Every week. Great. And I feel like I'm sorry that we have to stop because I feel like we just scratched the surface of your brain. And conversations like this get me so I don't know. I just get very excited about making things when I have a conversation with somebody who still is, you know, you could be coasting and you're still
scared to death.
And that's the next hour of conversation.
All right, man.
Thank you very much
for
doing
thanks.
This.
All right, cool. Thank you, man.
Hey, folks, that's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Bob as much as I did. And folks, tune in next week, because if you're like me and you love LA crime fiction, film noir, and detective stories set in this city, you're going to love Titus Welliver.
When I read the Bosch books, and I think it's also because I understand that guy, I there are many moments when I will have to close the book and weep a little bit. Harry's a guy you don't want to fuck with. No question about it. But this is a guy that's so profoundly injured. And I recognize that pain in the character.
If you don't know his name, you know his face. And I'm guessing that face brings up some somber, if not downright ominous images. His long career in television has comprised everything from Mobsters to Deadwood Bagman's Silas Adams to Lost's mysterious Man in Black. And after 25 years in the business, he now has his first lead role as L.A. Detective Harry Bosch. We talk about what it takes to bring a beloved literary character to the screen and how you get inside the mind of someone whose pain is largely internal. We also talk about Titus's father's influence on his career
and how having a really successful parent can be a double-edged sword. It's a fascinating conversation about the life of an actor, and you won't want to miss it. So I will see you next time off camera.